The Great Rift Valley is a name given to the continuous geographic trench approximately 6,000 kilometers in length that runs from Lebanon's, I'm going to really pronounce this wrong, Bekaa Valley in Asia to Mozambique in southeastern Africa.
Are you sure you're not thinking of the Great Valley and like tree stars and like Littlefoot and Sarah and Petrie?
No, I'm really thinking of the Great Rift Valley, which is a literal UNESCO World Heritage Site in, okay, in actual Africa.
Good. See, this is what I mean about you being well-read.
Well-read
right now. Hold on.
Yeah, dude, Wikipedia is the greatest. Don't tell our fans we're using Wikipedia for this. Our millions of fans.
Well, I'm using less than that, so like, you know, that's where I'm at.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of In the Name of Science. My name is Chris Givens, and I am joined this week, as always, by Nicole Baker, who, God bless her soul, brought me beer this week. Today we're going to be talking about a new avenue on treating infections, the origin of humans, and we're going to briefly talk about frozen mouse sperm in space. So stick with us. Okay, so at 11 minutes we're finally going to have some useful material.
Okay.
Pretty cool.
I feel like that's not as bad as, you know, what it could be in the past. It's only 8. Normally we wouldn't start till like 9, I feel like, so we're doing well.
Oh, yeah, we're moving right along. I mean, Sandy's not even home, and, you know, I'll just have to fry up some pancetta, and we're going to make some pizza. It's going to be delicious.
Yeah, sounds good. All right, so what are your thoughts on... All right, hold on. I got to get this shit together. Okay. I don't know how to start these things. I never know how to goddamn start these things.
Nicole, do you know who Jonas Salk is? Was.
I was going to say, I think he's passed.
Yeah, he's quite dead.
I've definitely heard of the man. He's like some vaccine guy.
He created the polio vaccine.
Right.
He also created one of my favorite quotes ever, which was when he was asked if he was going to patent the polio vaccine. Mm-hmm. He asked the reporter in return, how can you patent the sun? And he has now a research institute out in California named after him. Mm-hmm. It's called the Salk Institute. And as tends to happen with research institutes, they employ a shitload of really smart people.
Hopefully.
Well, no, they do.
Good.
And one of those really smart people at the Salk Institute is a delightful woman named Janelle Ayers.
I've heard that name before.
Where'd
Janelle, I don't know. I feel like that's like a name I've heard before in like some kind of science news. Is that a thing that I would have heard?
Well, yeah, she's making science news, and that's
well,
how you
there
might have
we
heard
go.
It.
Yeah, by golly,
damn, yeah, wow, wowie, wow, look at that.
Tell me more though, because that's the extent of my knowledge on this topic.
So, Dr. Ayers has her own lab out at the Salk Institute. She's, from what I gather, she's a relatively young PI. I think she got her PhD in 2009.
Oh, wow.
And she has a really interesting, in what this article on stats.com told me, or implied to me, a rather radical vision for how we treat bacterial infections in humans. and basically, she's really disappointed with the way that antibiotics work. Her father actually died a couple of years ago of sepsis.
Wait, that they don't work well enough at this point because we're developing resistances, or just they don't work well enough in general? Or
well, they don't work well enough in general. And the way they do work is, I think, in her mind, counterproductive. Yeah, like I said, her father died a couple years ago from sepsis, which is an infection in your bloodstream. And basically, the doctors tried to treat that with all manner of antibiotics, and they just didn't work. And part of that is probably because of resistance. And since the beginning of, you know, mass production of antibiotics, the scientists have been seeing that bacteria develop resistance to antibiotics within a handful of years from the development,
right,
of the antibiotic.
And correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of the types of antibiotics that we have are stuff that we found, you know, other bacteria to be creating to like combat rival bacteria in a population, you know.
I am not a big enough microbiologist to actually comment on that.
Okay. I don't think I entirely made that up, but I might have. So you can
I think that's definitely a place that people, if we haven't gotten antibiotics from there before, that is definitely a place that people are looking
at.
Yeah,
now. I feel like I've seen people, you know, oh, this, you know, species of soil bacteria is combating an invasion of this other type of bacteria by producing such and such compound. Maybe we can use that as an antibiotic in humans.
Yeah, so I think it's an ongoing place where people are looking for more antibiotics.
Gotcha. Okay.
I'm not sure if they've necessarily found them there before, though. But Dr. Ayers is interested not in making antibiotics, but in improving the way the human body responds to infection in the first place. And what she's noticed in some of her founding work that she did as a graduate student was in fruit flies. And she basically, she had a bunch of different genetic mutants of fruit flies that she infected with what, if I remember correctly, is the same level of bacterial infection across like 10,000 different flies. And what she found was that some flies, you know, given the same level of bacterial infection by the same bacterium, bacterial strain, some genetic mutants of flies actually survive those infections better than others do. And some can actually tolerate those infections and they live along with the infections.
Is there a situation where the infection is beneficial to a certain genotype of a fly?
I don't think she found exactly that. But what she did find was that basically there are some genotypes in the flies, at least, that were able to, they basically repaired their body better and they survived longer.
In response to infection. Okay, so they were able to combat the infection. They just dealt with it in a different way than the other flies.
Yeah, basically. Okay. And so this has led her to think, to believe and study this phenomenon that she believes is called tolerance in humans. And that's what she's calling it, is tolerance. Mm-hmm. And basically what it means is that I'm understanding it, and correct me out there, podcast land, if I'm wrong, but the way that I'm understanding it is that this tolerance means the way that the human body is tolerating the bacterial infection. Because lots of things happen when you get a bacterial infection. Mm-hmm. You may lose your appetite, your muscles may waste away, things like that. And people and organisms that retain their appetite and that don't lose muscle mass and don't lose weight overall during a bacterial infection, they tend to survive better, even if the infection doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. Or even if it does go away, they you know, someone who hasn't lost weight and has been eating more will survive better than someone who did lose a lot of weight and lost their appetite, just, you know, on average.
Sure. So she saw this in flies. Did any of the genetic determinants in flies that, you know, let a fly to coexist better with an infection or handle an infection better, did any of those, are those conserved in humans? Or does any of that translate to like higher species than flies?
That was her graduate work. I haven't really studied her papers from then on.
Fair enough. I wouldn't have either. Not because it's not interesting, just because I'm lazy.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that, but what I did notice, she hasn't really gotten to working on humans yet.
Okay.
She has been working on flies, though. Or, sorry. Fuck. She hasn't really gotten to working on humans yet, but she has been working on mice and in her lab.
Okay.
And specifically, she's interested in figuring out elements of the microbiome that may be integral to this tolerance response.
Like in your gut, basically.
Yeah, in your gut or really anywhere else.
So you keep finding out more and more that your gut controls and your flora of your gut controls more and more things or is a determinant. And
yes.
More and more factors of your health.
Yes, exactly.
Than we thought previously. Okay.
And so, yeah, she's been doing, she's had a couple of big papers out recently. One of them was in Science in 2015. And it described some research she did where she actually collected the same strain of mouse from all over the country. Basically, I'm not sure if they were Black 6 mice or some other kind, but basically the genetically identical mice from labs all over the country. So what that means is that while the genetics are the same, the microbiome is different.
Mm-hmm.
And then she infected them with intestinal and pneumonia infections and then assessed their survival and muscle wasting in the mice. And she found that some some mice were actually much, much more tolerant to these infections than other mice were. And that all of the mice that were tolerant to infections actually contained this particular strain of E. coli that when infection was present, it would migrate to white fat cells and trigger an inflammatory response there that somehow helps the body deal with infection.
Okay.
And what's even more interesting is that when the mice that were not tolerant to the infection were given this strain of E. coli, they became tolerant to infection.
Hmm.
So this is evidence that a particular strain of bacteria in the body may actually promote tolerance to infection and help keep the body healthy during infection, instead of letting it just sort of waste away.
Did that population of E. coli control the population of the infectious bacteria, or how did that work? This reminds me of my like little bugs in the soil example that I like might have potentially dreamed or made up earlier when I was like, you know, one species of soil bacteria controls and kills or whatever another invading species of soil bacteria.
Well, I don't think it was acting directly on the
okay,
other bacteria.
But it was stimulating the immune system to
it was
do,
stimulating,
do more.
Yeah, what's called the inflammasome, which I think is some sort of like broad-based inflammatory response.
Right.
So, yeah, it wasn't a direct like E. coli represses Salmonella directly, but
yeah.
it did, but it was sort of a it was a more circuitous route.
Mm-hmm.
Another paper that she described, or that she has published a little more recently, it involves a protein called Slurpee.
Slurpee?
Slurpee.
Like a 7-Eleven Slurpee?
Like, it's spelled S-L-R-P, but pronounced Slurpee.
Perfect.
I really kind of wish I did research on this particular protein. Basically, she took mice. These were not from collected from around the country. These are mice in her own lab. And she injected the mice with either, I think it was Salmonella, yeah, Salmonella bacteria that either contained the Slurpee protein or no protein at all. Or no Slurpee.
Yeah.
They either had Slurpee or no Slurpee.
Mm-hmm.
Probably a cherry flavored, maybe a Coke flavored Slurpee.
So you got the 7-Eleven reference? Like you have 7-Elevens in Virginia?
Yeah.
Okay.
I used to live in Northern Virginia, and we had 7-Elevens up there, but no 7-Elevens in Southwest Virginia. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
So... yeah, every time we go home, Sandy gets a Slurpee. Like, on, basically, like, we're gassing up to drive home and from her parents' house, and she's like, all right, Chris, go get me a Slurpee.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, she should.
Right. So after injecting these mice with the mutant Coca-Cola-flavored Slurpee, she found that the mice that received Salmonella containing the Slurpee protein actually maintained their weight and had better survival in response to infection than the mice who received Salmonella that did not contain this protein.
Mm-hmm.
And more research, more experiments showed that the reason this is because the Slurpee protein was blocking signals from the gut that tell the brain to tell the mouse to stop eating.
Okay.
The gut can talk to the brain and say, stop eating.
Know. Yep.
And apparently Salmonella infection will trigger that in the mice. And so the Slurpee protein just blocks that signal and the mice keep eating
so
normally.
So is Slurpee a secreted protein then, or is it just like on the surface of these E. coli? I don't...
That's a good question. I think... It would almost seem like it would be secreted, right?
Right. It seems like it would have to be able to interact with those receptors, whatever, you know.
I got to check out that mechanism. Yeah. But it basically would be, it blocked that transmission through the vagus nerve.
Interesting.
So
is her hypothesis, like, let's try to figure out if we can, you know, adjust our diet or adjust our gut flora in order to help us cope better as humans with infections as well?
I think it's more like adjust the gut flora and or design drugs that
work on those mechanisms
that provoke these responses.
Sure.
So like you could maybe, I mean, this is way out there, but perhaps you could design a drug where you deliver Slurpee, the protein, or some version of that to a human and like during infection, and that removes any barriers on appetite, and so they eat a lot, and it helps
and
them keep
healthy.
Their body healthy. I think she also the in, yeah, so I think she's also trying to dissect the various ways the microbiome works to counteract infections and to tolerate infections. And so yeah, maybe you can perhaps supplement people with particular strains of bacteria during infection. Mm-hmm. I sort of sifted through one of her reviews that she wrote, and this whole tolerance idea has been kind of controversial with immunologists. Mm-hmm. And it's also sort of goes against the way that we as a society think about treating and just even dealing with bacteria in general, because mostly our view of bacteria is that it is an antagonistic relationship,
right?
Especially with antibiotics, it's basically like just firebombing cities full of bacteria. And even a lot of microbiome research, you know, quoting from her review, is, you know, she sees it as people trying to pin the cause of various diseases on microbiome or on particular bacteria,
sure,
which is looking at bacteria as culprits as opposed to just sort of counterparts.
Right, they could be biology. Both. They are absolutely both. Like, exactly. I mean, there's a reason that our guts are populated with bacteria. There's kind of a symbiotic relationship there. We need to keep those good bacteria, quote unquote, healthy.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I'm imagining in the future, depending on how this research takes off, a very ancient Jamie Lee Curtis peddling a new type of yogurt to me in order to, you know, like Activia.
Oh,
you know,
that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. A new type of probiotic for my
probiotics that actually
for
work.
My tummy. Yes.
Yeah.
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 To help me in my tummy. Yeah. So that's really interesting. We'll have to follow that and see where that leads.
All of this.
Oh, there's more.
Just one more thing.
There's
really
more.
Just like the very, this is a little tiny cherry on top. Mm-hmm. I just really wanted to use the phrase mental masturbation, but I didn't.
You probably should have, because I'm going to say really terrible things in a minute. So,
just one more little tiny thing. This brings me back to "I Contain Multitudes" by mm-hmm. our boy Ed
by
Yong.
Your boy, yeah.
I guess, I mean, I'm a big fan
of
Ed Yong.
You're a huge, it's good.
I guess it is my fandom and not really ours, but
yeah.
Anyway,
you had a moment with him.
I met him. He signed my book and he was like, hey, you're a person.
That's a moment. You had a moment.
I mean, yeah. But when you're saying moment, like it was like a capital M, and I'm just, I mean, it was like, it was definitely a low.
It depends on what it meant to you.
It was very much a lowercase M.
Okay.
Moment. Well. Cause you know, it was just like a, you know, Sharpie on the front page and that was it. Mm-hmm. He gives a good talk though. That being said, he talked a lot in his book about there's, I think towards the end of the book, he gets on to how, shepherding around and sort of modifying the, microbiome is less like adding in, it's less like a druggable thing and more like an entire ecosystem you're trying mm-hmm. to modify. I've probably even talked about this on this particular podcast before. And it's a really interesting idea. And I think it's something, it seems like some Dr. Ayers in her research is getting at that a little bit. Like trying to, I mean, right now she's very much focusing on specific proteins and specific strains of bacteria. But just from reading the article and reading a little bit of her work, it seems like she's very much focusing on trying to elicit this holistic tolerance that comes from the body and the microbiome sort mm-hmm. of working as one, and trying to get them to say, okay, we're not just going to like roll over and let this infection take over the body. We're going to stand up a little bit and try to keep it in check a little bit. So it could even be that, you know, not only are you going to eventually stimulate appetite by giving people the slurpy protein, but mm-hmm. maybe you will also, you know, shepherd the microbiome into basically promoting the existence of bacteria that actually repress pathogenic bacteria growth, stuff like that. So it could be just like there could just be this many, many responses rolled into one that are in the end way less detrimental than just treating somebody with antibiotics.
Don't you feel sometimes like we're really in the generation that's on the cusp of really developing really powerful tools to study these scientific things that we've been slowly gathering information about over the, like the millennia, centuries, whatever, you know? And we're like
as
right
biologists,
on the cusp.
Yes,
biologists, precisely. That's mostly what I care about is biology. Yeah.
Well, I got to give a shout out to physicists who figured out how to make computers, which is like a lot of what is driving the omics revolutions in biology right now. Because if we didn't have the computational power to do it, then we couldn't be doing it.
Absolutely. I'm always, I get to thinking about that sometimes, and I'm just like, I know it didn't go this way, but this is how my brain works. I'm like, who is the guy who one day he was like sitting in his garage and he had like some tape and like a pipe and like some like wires and he was like, fuck. And he like put it together and like made a computer. I know that's not how that actually worked, but like, there's just,
I think that was Alan Turing in the
40s. Yes, I know.
Yeah.
I said, this is how my brain works.
Oh, okay. Got it. Yeah.
So anyway, if you haven't been able to tell from this podcast, my partner here, Chris, is extremely well-read and articulate. And I, as I like to say quite often, have approximate knowledge of many things.
All right. Shut up. Tell me about the mouse sperm.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to talk about,
okay,
but
good,
I only have
go.
Approximate knowledge of it. So,
cut it with the equivalating or whatever the word.
That's what I do. I'm a female.
Yeah. Well, I don't want it. You don't do that shit on this podcast. You don't do that here. You just bust in there.
All right, let's just bust into the mice jizzing in cups.
God,
okay.
God damn it.
So, I mean, how else do they get it? Let's be real. Okay. Anyway,
that's
so.
A good point.
I was
no. Actually, here's how you get this: if you are cryopreserving mice, you harvest the genitalia and you remove, like, you have to get like a shitload of testicles and a shitload of ovaries, and you basically like get all.
See, this is barbaric. I never worked with mice in grad school. I was just a cell biologist, and so I was like happily imagining little mice going into little rooms with little like sexy lady mouse magazines, and donating for the sake of science.
No, I don't
well,
think that's how that works.
Well, I reject your reality and substitute my own.
I think you should.
Anyway, I was perusing the internet, and I came across an article from The Guardian that briefly mentioned a Japanese scientist, of course.
I would really briefly like to mention how great The Guardian is.
Yeah,
like,
The Guardian is top notch. Yeah. Anyway, a Japanese scientist, we're slowly looking into, like, what happens to biological-based life forms in outer space? Can we colonize space as a species? So what the first step of this was, they took some mouse sperm and cryopreserved it and kept it in outer space at the International Space Station. And they wanted to see, like, having kept this mouse sperm in space and having it be exposed to, you know, cosmic radiation and just like the extreme environment of outer space, could you then bring that back to a planet and impregnate a lady mouse and have viable, healthy offspring? And it turns out the answer is yes.
Bam.
And the reason I did this with just sperm is because, you know, you can imagine the difficulty of having a mouse colony in space and dealing with that. Maybe you can't imagine that, but I can tell you it's probably a pain in multiple asses.
I'm having some real
flashbacks.
Yeah.
Yes.
You're triggering me, please.
I don't mean to trigger. Maybe I do. Anyway, so
that would be really difficult.
The next step of this, and you know, I don't recall if they sequenced the genomes of the offspring to determine if there were any genetic mutations or anything as a result, but in general the offspring were healthy that resulted from this in vitro fertilization.
Good.
From this cryopreserved outer space sperm. And so, kind of a big deal in terms of recolonizing other planets, or colonizing other planets, not recolonizing. Maybe recolonizing.
How do you
Earth.
Know we're not recolonizing?
I know
other
exactly,
planets.
Exactly. So this has like implications for human space travel, and, you know, populating other planets with other species, or, you know, bringing species back, you know, all sorts of things. And so the next step would be, can we grow embryos of mice in outer space? My question is just like, take some pregnant mice up there and see what happens. But again, pain in the ass, live mice.
Do you know if they've grown mice in space?
I have no idea. This is my first
knowledge. I really want them to have grown mice.
Again,
in space.
Approximate knowledge of many things. So
yeah,
that's kind of my mouse sperm and outer space story, which was my real exciting little thing I wanted to talk about today. The other thing that came out that the other night I was really hyped on, because I just was feeling good and like really appreciating anthropology at the time. Today I'm not so keen on it, but it's still extremely interesting for the origin of our current human race as we know it. So we always think, you know, the human race started in Africa. That's what we're all taught. Chris is not engaged at all right now. He's just like on his phone.
I'm trying to figure out if they've grown mice in space. I'm kind of
this
listening.
Is how I feel about this too. We're going to talk about the human race.
All right, go on.
No, you can find out if there was mice grown in space. Well, I don't know. So we all think of humans, the human race, the current human race, the ancestor of the human race, as having origins in Africa.
Yes.
Specifically in the country of Chad is where I think they found what they thought was the oldest remains of something that could be classified as hominin.
Isn't there the big-ass gorge there where all the humans came from?
I don't know if that's that or like some kind of sci-fi movie you watch. I'm unclear. I don't know. Like I said, I'm not a goddamn anthropologist. Okay. I just liked it last night. Google that, sir, instead of mice in space. So the point is, we think of human life, like modern humans, as originating in Africa, wherever it is, the Great Valley, the Great Rift Valley, wherever it is. However, new research has come to light, and it was published in PLOS One. Take that how you will. Some people really hate on PLOS One. I think they publish solid science, even if it's not the most exciting. This, to me, was exciting.
You got to judge it paper by paper.
Exactly. You have to judge it paper by paper, precisely. And so what they found is there were these samples. I think one was found in like the 40s in Greece, and one was found in 2012 in Bulgaria. And they've done some, you know, technology-ish things on them, like some kind of scans and reconstruction of them, like digitally. And, you know, other types of analysis. And they've determined that these, like, I think, let me check the date on this. So there was a jawbone and some teeth. And it's approximately 7.2 million years old. So this is older than the 7 million year old remains they found in Africa. And they're calling this Graciopithecus Freybergi. I think that's how you would pronounce that. And so the point is that the oldest hominin, essentially modern human ancestor that we found to date, is actually from Europe, not from Africa.
Weird.
Right. And so that's probably how it spoke.
Definitely cutting that one out.
What? That wasn't racist or anything. It was just like an old monkey.
A little bit. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the Neanderthals are going to come after us. You should finish talking. Keep talking.
So this Graciopithecus that they've determined was from, you know, either Greece or Bulgaria or something, again, approximate knowledge, it's about 200,000 years older than the earliest African hominid.
And Lucy, right?
I don't know. I don't know the difference between hominid and hominin. I remember as a child watching something about Lucy and the missing link. But what they're saying now is this could be the missing link. But it's only one, you know, like bits of remains here and there. So there are other anthropologists and other scientists who are saying, like, we need more data than just this. Most of what we know has come from Africa. Most of the oldest human remains have come from Africa. But this is it's really interesting thing. Like, What do we do with this? I don't think anything because it doesn't really affect my life. But I was really geeked about this last night when I read this. Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering, is it possible that, I mean, I don't know how all this used to look back 7 million years ago when everything was, I mean, it used to be, all the continents used to be a blob. And I'm wondering if maybe like our one little friend here or maybe like 100 of them or 1,000 of them just sort of wandered into where is now Europe.
Yeah, and that blob broke off of the bigger blob.
Yeah. But like maybe they still came from Africa. Is that possible?
I don't know the implications of that or how exactly anthropologists have worked out that Africa is, you know, I don't know like how they would classify things based on how like Pangaea or whatever used to be shaped or what have you.
Sure. Was Pangaea even a thing when humans were around?
I don't know. That's what I was just making a face at, is I don't know if that... See, this is, again, approximate knowledge of many things.
I feel like these things act on maybe longer timescales, possibly.
Absolutely. Man. So it's just kind of interesting, you know, where we came from. I don't know. That's really the gist of that bit of stuff that I had to talk about. So think about that if you care. The last thing I want to talk about has a more modern day... importance, if you will, is more, the last thing I want to talk about is more relevant in modern times, and that is humans are actually creating new minerals, human activity.
Go on.
So.
Wait, what?
Right. So I don't, have a ton to say about this. This is just a little tidbit I'm going to give you.
But just go along with us being in like the Anthropocene or whatever.
Exactly. Precisely. Mm. So we used to like, you know, it's like, when did the Holocene versus the Anthropocene eras in time, in geological time,
I've
start?
I've spent a lot of time trying to figure that out myself.
Oh, yes. Like just decades of your life.
He said sarcastically.
So what is he? The scientist named Robert Hazen, who actually has a mineral named after him called Hazenite.
Whoa.
Which is actually only in this one location in the world, and it's actually just basically bacteria poop that is only present.
That's the greatest.
It crystallizes when the water levels are low and it's very dry, and then when the waters come, it like demineralizes and like solubilizes, you might say, and so there's no more Hazenite. So anyway, neither here nor there. He is published a study in the Journal of American Mineralogists, and because humans have all these activities where we're like, you know, creating sludge and, you know, all the pollution-y things that we
cars,
do,
guitars,
we are actually creating new
farting
mineral entities on Earth, like as like a layer on like the Earth on top of other layers of minerals in the Earth.
Okay.
So like stuff that's never been identified before. And
oh, because we have all these like crazy synthetic things that we make, and
sure,
then byproducts from that. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. So there's really no talk about whether this is a good or a bad thing. You can make your own mind up about that for now. There's not a lot of research into this, but it's just like, wow, we're seeing new types of minerals, which,
yeah,
and a mineral is really just a substance that's able to form a crystalline structure, like a very
okay
organized crystalline.
Mm-hmm.
So like ice, water, when water freezes, ice is actually technically a mineral.
That's kind of crazy.
So I don't know. We'll see what becomes of this, but we're definitely leaving our mark on the planet.
Oh, yeah.
In more ways than we might have thought. I mean, we're creating new minerals, Marie. Again, Breaking Bad reference that you
yeah
just don't get because you were watching horrible television shows instead.
I can't believe I forgot that from the last,
no,
you know,
anyway,
from 20 minutes ago.
So those are like kind of a few little tidbits I wanted to talk about. You know, the origin of man, what man's doing to the planet, and what man's doing to mice in space. So
man's been doing a lot these days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Humans have been doing a lot these days.
This woman is going to drink some more beer now.
Mm-hmm. Did you know that Gary Larson, the creator of The Far Side, has an insect named after him?
No, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Did he discover it? Did he find it? Or
no.
Does it look like him? Like, I don't, why was it named after him?
That doesn't,
I
don't think it looks like him. Probably it doesn't look like him. He drew a lot of comics that were actually like pretty good science jokes. He especially like kind of made fun of Jane Goodall a lot, but like she thought it was really funny that he was doing that.
Good.
There was one in particular that it was like these two like chimpanzees sitting on a branch, and she picks like the it's a male and female chimpanzee, and she's like picking a long blonde hair off of the male chimpanzee, and she's like, "Oh, you've been hanging out with that Goodall tramp again, haven't you?" And like people got pissed about that,
but
one.
But she thought it was funny.
She thought it was hilarious.
Good.
Yeah,
I think I like her more now than I did before.
Yeah, I mean, because it's pretty funny. Yeah,
yeah.
I think it was it's a kind of, I think, beetle or some other insect like that that yeah, these scientists discovered, and they dug the far side, and the way it sort of makes fun of science sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And they named it after him.
Very
which is
cool.
Pretty great. I just thought of that when you said that this guy
the
has Hazenite.
Yeah,
yeah,
the bacterial poop.
Desiccated bacterial poo. That's pretty great.
Yeah. Well,
all right. Well, we're good. I think people have
turned this off
they're,
already.
They're now tweeting to tell people and their friends to stop listening.
Yeah.
So we'll end here. Say bye, Nicole.
Bye, Nicole.
Thank you all for joining us this week on In the Name of Science. This podcast was recorded and edited by Nicole Baker and Chris Givens. Our music was performed by Carl Bernock. And you can find us on the web at nameofscience.org and at ITNOScience on Twitter. Hope to see you all out next week.